All right, hey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So you were assigned the story originally. What brought you back to it?
So, I was assigned this way back when, in 2011. It was June 3rd that she went missing, and a couple days later, her parents had a friend reach out to the media. So I was in her hometown in Westchester, New York, one weekend, and got the call. So I came to Indiana to start digging into the case. Early on, I had met the family on the streets, and it was kind of not the friendliest relationship, because I was a reporter aggressively pushing for information about that night, and they were wanting this to be left to the police. But after going back to New York, I maintained a connection with the family, and our relationship got closer. A few years later, I had an opportunity where I could work at it full time, and I approached them again, and the case had been cold for a bunch of years by this point, and they agreed to speak with me like they'd never spoken to anyone before, and they opened all their investigative files to me, so that gave me a starting point for a fresh investigation of the case.
So you were able to talk to people that hadn't talked before, really. I mean, the people that were with her that night. How did you pull that off? I mean, how were you able to contact them and get them to talk to you?
So it started in about 2018 when the family and I sat down and they essentially gave me a green light that, okay, we'll cooperate with you. And their private investigators, in reading through all their files, had the names of various people that they had spoken with who were there that night, witnesses to the events leading up to her disappearance. So I approached them, and a lot of these people hadn't spoken to the media, were never reported of. But I approached them, and all of them had held back at the time, and they agreed to speak with me and share some very painful details. I think the case had followed a lot of them for years, haunted them, and they were ready to talk. So I started with, say, her roommates and her best friends, and worked my way down other witnesses who saw what happened in the moments leading up to her disappearance. And then I approached the last people to see her before she allegedly walked out of those townhouses.
Did it seem like they were forthcoming with what, everything, or not?
A lot of the people were forthcoming. When it came time to speak with the persons of interest in the case, that was much more of a challenge. I finally did get a couple of them talking. Corey Rossman, who was with Lauren that night, and ultimately spoke with me, and so did Jay, who was the last person to report seeing her. I think that having all the other participants or the other people in the mix speak with me, when I spoke with them, they were very aware of what I was doing. They knew who I was speaking with, and in fact, they were talking to each other behind the scenes. So, you know, ultimately they realized a couple of months before my deadline that they could talk, or they could, you know, let other people speak for the situation.
So you think it was just a matter of them wanting to get their version of the story out, or?
Well, I think that they've long been accused of withholding information, and they probably didn't want that perception to stand out.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I guess, theories about, you know, what happened to Lauren that night. Can you talk about some of what you heard or what you're exploring in the book?
Well, over the years, and you guys have reported on this and others about various serial killers, sex offenders, who, you know, some suspected may have been involved, but none of those theories went anywhere, and they were discounted. 13 years later now, we still have no evidence that Lauren ever made it out of those townhouses alive. So what I did with the book was dive into what we do know and present all, you know, facts like to really understand all the people she was with, what she was going through at the time, all of that, that helps tell the story of what happened.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, it wasn't kind of the most innocent of stories, you know, for Lauren. I mean, you were talking about her drug use and, you know, kind of the relationships that she was dealing with. Was that hard to deal with, you know, delve into, or?
I had reported on some of that early on. I think when I started speaking with people, it was a lot more going on that night than I'd ever reported, or that people knew. You know, I was talking to, the person who sold her Klonopin and Xanax that night, just a friend down the hall, and other people who were doing cocaine with her. All those people kind of paint a picture of students who were, this kind of activity was normalized. So when this book finally came out, I know that Charlene had reached out to me and said, please send me a copy, an advanced copy of the book, and that made me nervous, because for them to see, this all laid out in a narrative that would soon go public, that was nerve-wracking for me and difficult for her, but ultimately she did get through it and she posted her own statement on it.
So like you said, you've been one of the few journalists who were able to kind of get close enough to the family to talk to them in depth about this. Do they have any hopes of finding Lauren, or are they just wanting closure in the case?
13 years later, they still have to hold out hope, and they're as resolved as ever. I think they've been frustrated somewhat by the lack of new information coming out, which is kind of why they let me into this. And so here we are. I think that they are hoping, and we share that hope, that people will pay attention to this case again, and not just, as an anniversary story, but what happened that night. The facts are very important to dive into, and they're hoping that this will lead to more people coming forward, maybe one of the persons of interest, I'm hoping, or someone they spoke with, or someone else, if there indeed was someone else in the mix, after, if she indeed made it out of those townhouses, with all the attention, hopefully they'll come forward.
I was gonna say, why do you think the police case has dried up, and they had a private investigator, and that didn't solve the case either? Is it just people not talking?
Well, the police haven't shared any real details of what they found. They browbeat the persons of interest, saying that they weren't fully cooperating, and there were public demands for them to take police-administered lie detector tests. The efforts that were made, the kids, the central players in this, lawyered up and didn't speak. So there was a situation where, you can't suggest a crime, you can't finger point at an individual. They don't have evidence to support, obviously an arrest. So I'm not shocked that we didn't learn more at the time. I think going back, I could see that even people within the Bloomington Police Department, there were a lot of officers there who didn't think they were doing enough at the time, early on. The private investigators came to town a couple months later, and they made their own efforts, and they spoke to a lot of witnesses who said they were never contacted by the Bloomington Police Department, or certainly not interviewed in any serious way. But yes, they came up ultimately empty as well. But it, when you actually go back into their files and look at them all together and see the various discrepancies in what people were saying, or inconsistencies, you definitely have some fresh questions that could be asked.
Yeah, and I know I'm just remembering from back then that the private investigator didn't have a lot of kind words for the Bloomington Police Department.
No. You had the culture clash between people who are with the NYPD versus the Bloomington Police Force. So yeah, they made a, Bo Deedle made a derogatory comment that got a lot of press, and they somewhat horrified the Spearers too, because you know, that's not the kind of attention that they wanted. They wanted the attention on the case, and the Bloomington Police Department certainly didn't take kindly to what the investigators had said publicly. So there was very little goodwill or sharing of information as a result.
Yeah, so this case originated in Bloomington, but most of the players are from New York, elsewhere, around. So where all has the story taken you?
It's taken me, back to Indiana, where I spent some good time tracking down. Once I realized that the police doors were still shut, and then my FOILs were freshly rejected, efforts to get information about the case. I then tracked down officers and investigators who were there at the time, but no longer with the force. And yeah, I could get some of those conversations that led me to some new information. I went. A lot of this did. The players are in New York City. Lauren Spear was from Westchester, New York. Her family still lives there. So a lot of time, and the private investigative offices are in around Penn Station in New York City. So that was where a lot of the early time was spent. I came back to Indiana. I went to Colorado to try and speak with Jesse Wolf. That would be Lauren's boyfriend at the time. And I went to Massachusetts to speak with people associated with Corey Rossman. A lot of traveling.
You kind of talked earlier about, you know, there's so many different theories about what happened. Do you have one that you've kind of settled on after going through all the information that you have?
I certainly didn't. I'm not going to come down with an opinion on this. I wanted the facts to speak for themselves. And, I think people who are paying attention when read through this might, they'll see that there was no evidence that she ever made it out of those townhouses alive. Ask some fresh questions again, what happened up to that moment, and the central players, what did they say, and what other questions do you have for them?
Do you think the case will ever get solved?
Absolutely. I believe it will get solved. That's why I went about this mission, really, to put all the information on the table that I could find. All it takes is one person to call the police with a tip, and that could be one of the persons of interest or another individual if she made it out of that townhouse complex, or someone in their tight circle of friends or family who maybe they spoke with over time. One person coming forward could change the course of this entire case.
So is that what the takeaway you want from this book to be for
yes,
people?
Yes, this is not about, me just, this is not a vanity project. I went at this case because for many reasons I ended up as a key reporter on the case and established a good relationship with the family. I care about them. So that's absolutely the hope and expectation that new attention on this case will bring a resolution.
You know, what new information, you've talked to people that haven't talked before, so what new information do you think is coming out in your book?
Well, there's a whole bunch in there that you can only lay out in a book. One thing I found interesting was, we heard about some videos early on that showed Corey carrying Lauren and also of Lauren falling to the pavement. But what I learned from one of the former investigators was that at just about 3 a.m. that in the midst of all this, that Corey Rossman placed a phone call while Lauren was down on the curb, and this I think it was 3 a.m. Phone call that he made. I then was able to track down Corey's cell phone records and find out who he called, and that led me to track down the individual who he called, and so that was a whole new avenue of reporting.
Yeah, so just kind of, like you said, just another tidbit to chase down, right?
Yeah, but another tidbit to chase down, but when you string together the narrative of what happened that night, these are all key pieces of information, potentially evidence, because Corey, through his lawyer very early on, stayed silent, and his lawyer said that he had amnesia as a result of being punched that night. So he didn't remember anything about it. But when you dig into everything about what witnesses saw and heard, you see that there were moments along this, you know, these last minutes and hours where Corey did interact with individuals and Lauren didn't. Mm-hmm. She was in somewhat of a haze, not speaking. He was doing all the talking, and you saw that even when she was on the steps at one point and smacked her head, a witness came up to her and Corey and asked, "How are you doing?" And she couldn't even reply. And Corey did the talking. So the question is, did he really have absolutely no memory of anything that happened? Everything kind of plays together.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, is it just as simple as she could have OD'd or something, and then it's just, what do we do with her?
Well, that's yes. There's a question of whether, because she had a heart condition, because she was mixing drugs and alcohol, and because she had fallen several times and she had hit her head, she was in very bad shape. Even by Jay Rosenbaum had shared that she had a blackening under her eye. So that leads to the question, all of that, whether she died during that night, and that would beg the question of what happened next. And yes, one theory is that some of the people who were with her panicked at that point because, yes, they were involved in the mix of that night. Here we are all these years later with that some of those same questions.
Yeah, because I think they've changed the law since then, right, to where if you're in that kind of a situation, you can call the police without worry of being incriminating yourself or anything like that.
That's right.
Okay. All right, well, I appreciate you taking the time.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, man.